The following was recorded at 4 p.m. Eastern Time.
Defining Americanism today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. Donald Trump says Americanism is his guiding principle. A Muslim in New Jersey wonders if that includes her.
I'm also an American and a devout American, I guess you can say. I was born and raised here, so this is what I call home.
Plus, young immigrant musicians trying to make it in America, but can they wait tables in between gigs?
Well, that's often very unclear. Because
yeah, it's very unclear.
I talked to a few lawyers, and my lawyer says don't do it. So.
And my lawyer said do it, so.
Yeah, who knows?
And later, a teenage climate activist busts a rhyme.
Please, I'm begging on my knees. I'm harboring almost as many tears as there will be climate refugees. Can't you please see how easy it can be to compost?
Those stories and more today on The World. We've been following news today out of Munich, Germany, a headline that we've seen before, a shooting spree, this one at a shopping mall on the north side of Munich. There are few confirmed details right now, but police in Germany have said there are several dead and wounded. We'll have the latest on that developing story later in the show. Right now, let's turn to Donald Trump and his acceptance of the Republican nomination for president. In his 75-minute speech last night, Trump laid out some of the central points of his campaign.
Americanism, not globalism, will be our credo as long as we are led by politicians who will not put America first. Then we can be assured that other nations will not treat America with respect, the respect that we deserve.
Americanism, not globalism, will be our credo. Well, I've got two of our reporters here, Anjali Shah and Maria Muriel, to talk about what that word might really mean, Americanism. Anjali oversees our Facebook group, the Global Nation Exchange. It's a space for people to talk about immigration and diversity. Maria was in Cleveland covering the Republican convention, is back now in Boston. Maria, what is your sense of how Trump supporters of the convention think of Americanism?
It seems like there's a really strong emphasis on America being better than all other countries, which is something we see a lot, right? America is the best. It's the best country on earth. And that's a fairly common sentiment, right? But there's also a huge fear of illegal immigration that comes along with this interpretation of Americanism as I witnessed it at the RNC.
So exceptionalism plus fear equals Americanism. Anjali, what's your take on the meaning of the word Americanism?
When I was watching the response of the mostly immigrants who are part of the Global Nation Exchange, they have a range of feelings. They're not surprised about Trump's rhetoric, but they are afraid of what it could mean for them, both in terms of what his specific policies would end up being and how it'll affect their neighbors and how they feel about immigrants in their communities.
It's interesting because there's fear on both sides there. Mm-hmm. You know, you see people who support Trump that are really fearful of illegal immigrants, right? That's the rhetoric. And actually last night, I think he said, you know, we need to talk about the threat of illegal immigration. And then here we have people in the exchange, Anjali, that are fearful themselves.
Yeah. So not too big a surprise that fear is a common answer on the Global Nation Exchange. What else are you hearing, Anjali, about reaction to the whole kind of idea of Americanism?
Well, one particular story has stood out to me. Marcel Hutchins, who has contributed to The World and to Global Nation in the past, shared something that happened to her. She's lived in Boston for 4 years. Her family immigrated from Cameroon. For the first time, she was yelled at on the street by passerbys who said, yelled at her, Black lives don't matter. Mm. And while we don't know whether this is because of Trump or not, she's feeling a heightened sense of worry that people are empowered to harass or mistrust their neighbors.
On this whole subject of what Americanism is, Maria, you were in Cleveland and asked people what they thought it meant to be an American. What kind of answers did you get?
The most common one was freedom. Everybody talked about freedom, whether they were a Trump supporter, whether they were unsure who they were voting for, or whether they were Clinton supporters or just, you know, regular old riler-uppers. Everybody talked about freedom. That's what people think America means. And there were some people who also mentioned the Second Amendment as a really big part of what that freedom is. I had somebody tell me that the Second Amendment protects all the other freedoms that the Constitution grants us.
Right to bear arms.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this whole credo of Americanism, how do you think it would play out? I know a lot of people are wondering, if Trump were president, what would be the scene? But how would this play out if he were in office?
The first two things that come to mind to me are deportations and the economy. Democrats do deport people, and nobody should forget that. But, you know, it's very clear that Donald Trump is intent on removing undocumented people from the country. And also, I just feel like when you're setting yourself up to be the best country in the world and better than everybody else, does that make it harder to negotiate with other nations?
Anjali, what about you? How do you think this credo of Americanism would play out if Trump were president?
Most of the immigrants that I've spoken to about what they worry about Trump is that they're not sure what his policies actually mean. He says he wants to deport undocumented immigrants, but the Obama administration has deported between 350 and over 400,000 people a year during Obama's term. So I think what a lot of people want to know is, what more can be done? What more does Trump want to do for undocumented immigrants and their families? I think that's their main concern when they think about what being an American or Americanism could mean going forward.
I just thought it was really interesting that at the convention, it was sort of unclear for me what being an American meant. You know, there was a lot of references to putting Americans first. And I just wanted to be like, who is that, though? Mm. Like, what does that mean? Because it was, what was actually clear was who were not Americans, which were radical Islamist extremists, right, as the speaker said throughout the week, and illegal aliens, right? This phrase that kept being used, those were not Americans. But sort of everybody else could be. And I wasn't entirely sure when they referred to Americans what exactly they meant.
It seemed to me that Trump, on the one hand, wanted to bring people in as Americans. For example, the section about the shootings in Orlando where he courted LGBTQ Americans. But he also brought in people by saying what was not American, in this case, quote unquote, foreign ideologies. But it was always very vague as to what that meant.
Final question for both of you. What has it been like to be a person of color, a hyphenated identity, covering this election so far? Anjali?
Well, I don't know that I think of myself really as a hyphenated identity. I think we all have things about us that are different and diverse and make us interesting, frankly. For me, though, I know that, you know, no matter what journalism I do, there's a certain subset of people who will always question my motives. And I think the Trump rhetoric, especially about media writ large and about immigrants, has heightened that. We certainly see a lot of trolls following us on Twitter and saying things that are pretty xenophobic.
And Maria?
It's been hard, actually, to cover this, especially being at the convention. And I've been thinking about it a lot and talking about it a lot with colleagues. You know, when we talk to people with a wide range of opinions, like I've done over the course of this week, we present them as they are. We respect them. Those are Americans. Those are our sources. They are people that we're interviewing. When we cover politicians as journalists, it's our job to kind of hold them up to a different standard, right? And we have to examine everything that they say, and we have to fact check them. Donald Trump makes it difficult to do that without it seeming like I have a horse in this race, I think, you know, especially with the rhetoric that Anjali mentioned that he has toward the media.
The World's Maria Muriel and Anjali Shah, thank you both very much.
Thank you, Marco.
Thanks, Marco.
Our conversation on Trump's campaign, immigration, and what Americanism actually means continues online. Just search for the Global Nation Exchange on Facebook. One of the groups Donald Trump has been most vocal about is Muslims. He's called repeatedly for a ban on Muslim immigration to this country. So as he spoke at the Republican National Convention last night, Muslims across the nation were listening closely, like Omar Awad and his wife Marwa Masrani. They tuned in to watch Trump's speech at their house in Lodi, New Jersey. We sent reporter Daniela Cheslow, who's usually based in the Middle East, to watch with them.
Hey, how are you? Glad you made it.
Hi.
When I get to the home of Omar Awad and Marwa Masrani, the first order of business is a fruit tart, which Omar takes out of a plastic shopping bag.
Thank you. Need to hear for some tart.
In honor of Trump?
No. This is just for having a guest over.
Omar and Marwa live in a townhouse in Lodi. They say all their neighbors are Muslim, mostly from Turkey. Their families come from Egypt. Marwa's 25, and she says she's a devout Muslim. She wears a headscarf, and she follows the religious rules.
I'm also an American and a devout American, I guess you can say. I was born and raised here, so this is what I call home.
Her husband, Omar, was also born in New Jersey, although he lived in Egypt for 10 years as a kid. Omar worked in biomedical engineering and is now the president and CEO of the largest mosque in the area, the Islamic Center of Passaic County. Omar and Marwa say watching the Republican National Convention this week has been an evening ritual. They've been paying close attention to comments about Muslims and immigrants.
After a lot of the different terror attacks that took place throughout the globe, Donald Trump was saying that we need to ban Muslims and we need to, or Congress need to figure out what the hell is going on. I don't think Islam or Muslims are an epidemic that you need to figure out what's going on.
I think what's concerning is that, like, the fear-mongering is working and that people are behind some of what I guess you can consider the hate speech that he's saying. So it's a little concerning that there are so many people that are okay with that.
Suddenly, Omar's phone goes off.
That's an Aisha prayer, our last prayer of the day. This was just a call for the then.
Your phone goes off every prayer time?
Every prayer time, yeah. That's the beauty of having Islamic apps.
After 4 years of Hillary Clinton, what do we have?
Midway through the speech, Trump brings up the Middle East and claims that as Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, quote, almost single-handedly destabilized the entire region, and that during her tenure, Egypt was turned over to the radical Muslim Brotherhood before the military took control. Listening to that, Omar says Trump doesn't know his Egyptian history.
There was a revolution in Egypt, then an election, and then a coup.
He also seems to be blaming or giving Hillary credit for, like, the Arab Spring, basically.
And then Trump brings up the issue of immigration and refugees from the Arab world.
We must immediately suspend immigration from any nation that has been compromised by terrorism.
So he's kind of put some parameters to the blanket statement that he made, a ban on all Muslims. And he's like, the ones that have been compromised by terrorism. So what does that mean? Is that only certain Muslim countries? That either way, it's still troublesome.
Even while the Trump campaign rhetoric has been unsettling for Marwa and Omar, they say they feel supported as Muslims in New Jersey. Omar says his mosque just opened a second campus and town councilors were there to wish them well. Marwa says her company asked her to give a presentation last month about the Muslim holy fasting month of Ramadan.
And then they're like, thanks for this. Is there anything we can do to make this month easier on you? Is there anything we could do to accommodate? And we're like, no, everyone's been so nice and so accepting.
They note that one person who did a lot for local Muslims in New Jersey was Governor Chris Christie. Back in 2011, Christie appointed a Muslim lawyer to be a judge in New Jersey Superior Court in Passaic County. Now, Christie is one of the bulldogs of the Trump campaign.
Governor Chris Christie came to our center before he became a governor. He knows the Muslim community firsthand. He turned his back on the Muslim community. And it was very, very, very disappointing to see.
In the end, Marwa and Omar say the most remarkable part of the night is what they see as the lack of any real plans in Trump's speech, yet the crowd loved it. Next week, they'll be tuned into the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia to hear what Hillary Clinton has to say. Marwa went to the same college as Clinton, Wellesley, but she says she was a Bernie Sanders supporter. She says Clinton hasn't connected with her yet. For The World, Daniela Cheslow, Lodi, New Jersey.
A quick look ahead before we take a break. In Canada, a teenage climate activist fights for labels on gas pumps, and she's not pulling any punches.
It's just like the cigarette labels. If we can put those graphic cigarette labels that are terrible, like nasty to look at, we can bring it upon ourselves to put this on something that will endanger not only our health, but the planet's health.
That story's coming up in just a few minutes. Stick around. You're with The World. In the 1960s and 70s, many Americans fled north to Canada as conscientious objectors during the Vietnam War. Many were allowed to stay. Something similar happened during the Second Iraq War, but the future is uncertain for these war resistors. Under the previous conservative Canadian government, many of them were deported. Then came the election of Canada's current Liberal Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau. He promised to pave the way for American war resistors to stay on Canadian soil. But as I heard from Michelle Robidoux today, that hasn't happened yet. Robidoux is a spokeswoman for the War Resisters Support Campaign in Toronto.
Since the election 9 months ago, unfortunately, very little has happened on this question. And some of the things that the candidates had talked about that they would change have not changed yet. So U.S. war resistors who came up here most of them between 2005 and 2008 are still living in limbo and are still under the threat of deportation. So we're pressing and hoping that the new government will change this, but so far not much has happened.
Why has nothing changed despite those promises?
The government has been given a deadline of September 16th to indicate whether or not they are going to continue litigation that was begun by the previous government, by the Harper government, against U.S. Iraq war resistors. So the time is running out to make that decision, and I don't think there's any doubt that most Canadians would want them to stop prosecuting U.S. war resistors and trying to deport them. In fact, a poll was conducted just a few weeks ago that found that 3 out of 5 Canadians want U.S. war resistors to be allowed to gain permanent resident status in Canada.
How many American war resistors are currently in Canada?
At this point, we are aware of 15 cases.
And if they're technically not supposed to be in Canada, can you describe what life is like for these 15 or some odd people living in Canada? Are they stigmatized?
No, I'd say to the contrary. Most people are incredibly sympathetic and appreciate the stance that they have taken and appreciate the cost to them in leaving their country and leaving their families and so on. So they're not in any way stigmatized in that sense. I think, though, as people who have no status here, they don't benefit from basically the security of knowing that you're not going to be deported. And a number of war resistors have been deported under the Harper government and sentenced to harsh jail terms as a result of their opposition to the Iraq war. So we know what await war resistors. And I think because of that, Canadians feel very strongly that if anybody should be punished because of the Iraq war, it certainly shouldn't be soldiers who said no.
Yeah. So what do you think is going to happen? Will they be deported too, like a lot of these other conscientious objectors? Or do you think Justin Trudeau will keep his promise?
We're fearful that because nothing has happened so far, and, you know, the glow of a new government with a very different outlook from everything that they have said, the fact that nothing has happened yet is very worrying for us. And the consequences to these individuals, if they are forced back, are quite grave. A number of the war resistors suffer from psychological injuries of different sorts, in particular post-traumatic stress disorder. And so to be sent back to face court-martial and to be jailed, the consequences are quite dramatic. But we are hopeful still, because all of these cases could readily be resolved with no fanfare. So we think that support is important, and we think that if we keep discussion going and keep putting attention on it, we do think there are people in this government that are listening.
Michelle Robidoux, spokeswoman for the War Resisters Support Campaign in Toronto. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's stay north of the border for this next story. It looks like a carbon tax or something like it will be coming soon to Canada. Environment Minister Catherine McKenna says she'll announce a plan for what she calls a carbon price this fall as part of the country's efforts to fight climate change. Meanwhile, though, a somewhat smaller but more novel effort to fight climate change is coming to the country as well. Gas pumps in the city of North Vancouver, British Columbia, will soon be affixed with warning labels. The World's Andrea Crossan has a story of the teenager who helped make it happen.
Emily Kelsall introduces me to her leopard gecko. His name?
Earl. I got him when I was like in grade 4, believe it or not. These guys live a long time, but he hasn't aged a day pretty much.
Emily herself, though, is growing up. She's 18 now and already a seasoned climate change campaigner and public speaker.
Good evening, Honorable Mayor and Council members. My name is Emily Kelsall.
That's Emily at a city hall meeting in North Vancouver last summer. She was speaking on behalf of a climate activist group called Our Horizon.
I want the city of North Vancouver to be the first government in Canada to implement the placement of warning labels on retail gas pumps, cautioning on the disastrous effects of climate change.
She really struck a chord with the council.
Daryl Musato is mayor of North Vancouver. This is a pretty progressive area. The province of British Columbia is one of the few places in North America that has a carbon tax to help fight climate change. So Emily's idea caught fire.
She really got our interest. So we did some investigation and we found out that, yes, indeed, we do have the ability to do that.
The council agreed in principle to put the labels on pumps at the city's gas stations, all 6 of them. But then came the discussion of what the labels should actually look like.
It's critical and vital that we do make them, like, a little bit uncomfortable to look at. Because if we don't, what's the point in having them?
Emily Kelsall was hoping they would have a strong message.
It's just like the cigarette labels. If we can put those graphic cigarette labels that are terrible, like nasty to look at, we can bring it upon ourselves to put this on something that will endanger not only our health, but the planet's health.
One of the sample labels that Our Horizon designed bore a photo of dead coral reef. For obvious reasons, the gas companies weren't so keen on that idea. They wanted a set of messages about smart fuel consumption, like taking a roof rack off your car when you don't need it, with a sentence making the connection between fossil fuels and climate change.
People generally are quite well aware of that connection already.
Andrew Klukas is president of the Western Convenience Stores Association. He represents some of the owners.
But yes, we discussed that with the city, and they wanted to have one sentence at the bottom making that connection, reminding people that, yeah, it is about helping the planet. You know, we can do something here and we should do something.
We're not trying to sell death and gloom here.
Mayor Masato agreed that the gas pump labels shouldn't be like warning labels on cigarette packs.
What we're trying to do is inform people and help support them make better decisions.
So the labels ended up with a positive message supplied by the gas stations, and a negative one reminding consumers that by squeezing that pump, they are contributing to climate change. But Emily Kelsall isn't discouraged by the compromise. She realizes that life is complicated.
Like, I'll admit, like, driving is a convenient thing. I think the most important thing is that we, like, maintain, like, a conscious awareness about what we're doing, which is what these labels will bring. So, like, yeah, don't eat meat, drive a hybrid, take the bus when I can, and advocate for the things I care about. I'm a human, just like everybody else, though.
And she's getting her blunter message across in different ways, like a slam poem she wrote.
Climate change, oh climate change, a secret snake slithering underneath our self-centered subconscious. I fight. Oh, Nelly, I fight. I muster up courage like a puffin' and huffin' fire starter in a cold black mind and remind people, please, I'm begging on my knees. I'm harboring almost as many tears as there will be climate refugees. Can't you please see how easy it can be to compost?
The new gas pump labels will appear in Emily's small Vancouver suburb in the next few weeks. Since North Vancouver adopted the idea, other Canadian cities have passed resolutions in favor of similar labels. And here in the U.S., Berkeley, San Francisco, Santa Monica, and Seattle are all considering the concept. For The World, I'm Andrea Crossan, North Vancouver.
If you want to hear the rest of Emily's slam poem and see some of the sample labels, it's all at PRI.org. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. We're following reports of a shooting attack at a mall in Munich, Germany. An eyewitness says the situation is very unclear.
Here we've seen just ambulances and it's like firemen and police. The streets are blocked. The people are scared. Everybody are running around.
More on that story coming up on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. The news alert seems so familiar at this point, but not any easier to read. Today in Munich, Germany, there was a shooting attack at a shopping center there. Police are saying there are several dead and wounded and that they're looking for as many as three gunmen right now. But at this hour, the details are still very hard to confirm. Sarah Heinrich is a local news reporter at M94.5, a radio station in Munich, and she was just a few miles from the site of the attack when it happened. Where were you exactly, Sarah, and how did you find out something was going on?
At the moment it was taking place, I was actually outside and I was wondering because there were a lot of helicopters and a lot of ambulances crossing my way. And then, you know, the news feed was on my cell phone and then I realized that it was an attack in Munich. But first, you know, I thought it would be nothing seriously because we would have another attack in northern Bavaria just this Monday. But then when I was switching on the radio, they said that there were probably several places attacked. So I really went back home straight, and then I heard the news that there was this attack and that, you know, no one knew what was going on there.
Forgive me if you said this, but did you see any signs from where you were that an attack was going on?
Yes, you could see it like through whole Munich because there were a lot of ambulances and a lot of police and also a lot of helicopters.
What have you heard from any of your friends who were in the area?
Yes, I have a friend of my friend. She was in that area, you know, just accidentally in the bus. And this bus was actually close to the place at the shopping mall where this was taking place. And she wrote a text message. I'm just going to read it out because she was like, I'm super, super shocked. I didn't know what to do. I was just there seconds after that shooting in the bus, and I could see people, and they were running anywhere, and I could see people lying on the ground, and there was blood. And this is what she wrote. And, you know, when I heard that, I knew that there was something seriously going on.
Have you heard from your friends since those texts? And how are they doing? And where are they right now?
They're at home right now. You know, they're more or less fine, but they're safe. But I know that they're like about 6 people dead right now, and a lot of them are in hospital, of them which were in that attack.
How has your radio station, M94.5, been reporting all this?
We've been doing a live stream the whole time. You know, this is more or less funny that we were actually planning our summer festival at our radio station, and I was actually going there, but then this all happened, you know, but now there's some colleagues and they're doing a live stream, and, you know, there was no more barbecue after that.
What have you been hearing from police at this point about any of this event?
Well, the police, they didn't know actually what was going on, because the thing was that there were a lot of rumors all over the news, because the first thing I heard was the attack at the Olympic Center. And then also they were saying that there was another attack at the city center in Munich, because the shopping center is a bit far away from the center or from the city center. And then they were talking about another attack at another place. So I had the impression that the police didn't know exactly where to go first. And, you know, it was just a big mess in whole Munich. And they, you know, they would have to inform the citizens, and they would have to inform everyone. But yes, it was just a big chaos.
So, Sarah, you said you've gone home at this point, but there is a lockdown and shelter in place order in effect. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes. No, that's right. They've been informing us by cell phone, Twitter and Facebook. And they've been also doing this safety check by Facebook. And yes, they all wanted us to go home. And I have some friends, they were at the city center right now, and they would have to go into a store, and they wouldn't go out for I don't know how many hours because of what it was too dangerous for them to go out into the streets again.
Sarah Heinrich, thank you very much.
Yes, you're welcome.
That's Sarah Heinrich. She's a news reporter at M94.5, a radio station in Munich. Let me turn to the world's Matthew Bell, who's with me in the studio. He's reported for us recently from Germany on security issues. Matthew, you've been in touch with German police officials. What did you hear from them?
Yeah, as we just heard from Sarah, it's a confusing situation. And that's one thing the police were very straightforward with me. The spokesman I talked to said, look, this is really chaotic. We don't know exactly how many suspects we had. He thought there were 3, but he said, honestly, it could be 1, 2, or 3. And the police deployed in Munich, they, as you said, they had the shelter in place order. They just set up roadblocks and said, spokesman told me, they're just looking at the whole city and were searching for these guys and weren't sure if they were planning another attack or they were trying to escape. Marco, just while you were talking with Sarah, I noticed the Munich police on Twitter have now said that the death toll, 8 people in Munich now confirmed dead after the shooting, and then several more injuries.
It's interesting, as we've been watching kind of calls of who might this be, there's been some early speculation that it might be terrorism. Then the German officials backed way off and said, we don't know what this is. I'm just curious what you see in that hesitancy to go out on the edge and kind of assume that this is whatever it is.
Yeah, yeah. So, of course, I asked the police spokesman, at this point, you know, do you have any indication that you know whether this is a terrorist attack or not? And he said, well, it certainly is a terrorist attack, but we don't know who, we don't know why. He said maybe this is a radical Islamist. We just don't know. Maybe these are right-wing extremists. We just don't know at this point. He said, you know, well, they're putting out information. They seem sort of very forward-leaning and reaching out to the media on Twitter and otherwise. But they are being very careful about how they characterize this thing.
Yeah, it just shows how ambiguous everything is right now. What about the police and security forces in Germany? You were there. You looked into the security situation there right now. What have they done to prepare for this kind of attack?
I was there in late last year, and this was after, you'll remember, the Charlie Hebdo attacks. That was a huge issue in Germany, and I sat down and talked with police officers in Berlin, and they said that they were worried about their capabilities. They said, look, for years and years, Germany would never really have to deal with this kind of a mass shooting. They said in the United States, it's a very different situation. Lots of people have guns. But in Germany, they were sort of suddenly, especially after that attack, there was a huge political debate about what should the police be doing to prepare for this kind of thing. You know, look at since then, we've had the attack at the Bataclan in Paris, the Brussels attacks, the Nice attack just recently. And another one in the news was this Afghan teenager who is a migrant in Germany attacked people in a train. I mean, this
that
stuff
was just this week.
Is all over the news, and it's very much in the consciousness. Well, the police over the last 6 months or so they've developed a new special forces police unit. It's based in Bonn. I think it's 500 officers. Apparently, they're able to deploy anywhere in the country within 2 hours by helicopter. The spokesman I talked to today said they are being deployed in Munich. I think this is the first sort of, you know, real active shooter type of situation that they've been deployed in.
And we have to remember the context here, too, of Germany, which is kind of like the dream destination for so many hundreds of thousands of migrants fleeing Syria and Iraq. When you were there, what was the mood in Germany about this whole picture?
I mean, yeah, and again, you know, with this situation in Munich, we don't know who this was yet and what it was about. But the whole story of the migrants is just enormous, and you kind of can't overstate it. More than 1 million migrants have come into Germany in the last year or so. It's a hugely contentious political issue. There's one side that has been very welcoming. Angela Merkel, the chancellor, has been, you know, taken a real proactive position on these, you know, Germany should stand up, do the right thing, welcome these people. But then there's an other side of the political spectrum, which is really upset about the way this has been handled, the numbers of people that have come in, and the kind of what they see as lack of planning and transparency from government officials about what's going to happen with this population that's arrived, so many people so suddenly. So this is the backdrop, I think, of the terrorism issue, and it gets conflated and people are nervous about it.
The World's Matthew Bell. Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
Let me bring in Callum. He is an Australian tourist and is in Munich. He doesn't want to use his last name for privacy reasons, but he's staying at a youth hostel in the center of the city. Callum, thanks for being with us. Can you just tell us what you have seen this evening?
Hi. So this evening, me and my friends we saw the sights during the day. Headed back to the hostel about 3 hours ago and just checked our phones and saw that there was a shooting, which was about 5 kilometres away from where we were staying. We didn't think that this would kind of affect us because it was a little while away. So we decided to go out and find somewhere to eat. And we were about 200 metres away from the hostel, right near the Munich Hauptbahnhof, which is like the main regional train station, when everyone just started running for no apparent reason. We didn't hear any gunfire or anything like that, but just everyone started running. We ran, pretty much the streets were deserted within 10 seconds, and we ran to the hostel. Everyone went up into their rooms. There were police. There's still police everywhere at the moment. So that was, I suppose, my experience of, today in Munich.
Yeah, so otherwise your day was uneventful. Did you know at the time, with all the people running around and the chaos, what was going on? Did you have any idea?
Yeah, so I'm not 100% sure what the reason was. We're about a kilometre away from the main square, which apparently something happened there, but obviously I can't confirm that. But I suppose just the mood of the people on the streets, everyone's pretty, I suppose, watching over their shoulders. that things are slowly returning to normal. Like, there's more people on the street now. There's people in restaurants. We're kind of just staying in this area and not really traveling around at the moment.
Did you hear anything like gunfire?
No, didn't hear any gunfire. Basically, everyone panicked, run. I'm not sure why they did, but I suppose when you see people running, you don't stop and look around as to why they are.
Did you get or hear the order to shelter in place, the lockdown order?
I did go out on the street about an hour ago, which was about 2 hours after we all ran back into the hostel, and there was police officers with megaphones telling everyone that the public transport is shut down, everyone has to walk home. I'm not sure whether it was a shelter-in-place warning, but there's a lot more foot traffic on the streets now. People don't seem to be as worried as they were. There's minimal car traffic, but no one seems that concerned at the moment. There are sirens in the distance, but that's about all that is normal at the moment.
So what does it feel like to be back at the hostel right now?
It's a bit eerie. It's good. You feel somewhat safe there, but I suppose everyone's on their phones contacting their loved ones, letting them know, you know, they're all right. It's just I suppose because usually most people would be heading out tonight to go and see the sights, whereas everyone's pretty much down at the bar in the hostel just staying put and just, I suppose, making the most of a bad situation.
How will you spend the rest of your holiday in Munich, Callum?
Well, I'm not 100% sure. That's dependent on whether, you know, public transport resumes tomorrow or not. I'm somewhat wary about visiting, I suppose, the main tourist sites, for obvious reasons. But I don't think I'll let this deter me because, you know, there's, in the end of the day, there's nothing I can do if something like that were to occur.
Callum, thank you very much for speaking with us. Really appreciate it.
No worries. Thank you very much.
That was Callum. He's from Australia and a tourist right now in Munich. Let me bring the world's Matthew Bell back into the conversation just briefly. Matthew, you heard that. He's Australian, Callum is. You were in Germany. How do Germans feel about their security? Do they feel their government's doing enough?
Yeah, it's a huge debate in Germany right now. The country is going through enormous changes with more than a million migrants that have come in and people talking about what that means for the country. You know, and the other thing is just everything, you know, in the news, this stuff, the news travels so fast. President Obama was very quickly briefed about this and has commented about it already, saying that you know, we're here for the German people and whatever they need. The German Interior Ministry apparently was on traveling to the United States and is canceling his trip and going back. And German officials are organizing emergency meetings for this. So it's an ongoing situation, but these are things that are going to be enormous in the coming weeks and months.
The world's Matthew Bell. Thank you very much. And I have to stress, this is a rapidly evolving breaking news story, but here's what we can say about it so far. Police in Germany are treating a shooting at a shopping mall in Munich as a possible terrorist attack. They say they are looking for as many as 3 suspects who are still on the run, and the authorities are now saying that as a result of this shooting, 8 people are dead and many more are wounded. Sad news out of Munich, Germany. Stay tuned to your public radio station for the latest news bulletins. And we'll have the latest information on this attack in Munich as we learn it over at PRI.org. I'm Marco Werman with The World. Making it as a musician in America can be tough, but for one group of young musicians in Los Angeles, the real challenge has been getting permission to stay in the U.S. The World's William Troop explains.
I first saw the band Nightlights in late 2014. I took my daughter to a concert at a small venue here in Boston, and Nightlights were the opening act, playing songs like this one off their first EP. At the time, the four members were still students at Boston's Berklee College of Music. They'd met there as freshmen and have been playing together ever since.
I'm stubborn and confused. I fought to stay the same. Yeah, 'cause who needs change?
But after 4 years at Berklee, they faced a decision. See, Nightlights is a multinational band. Lead singer Mauricio Jimenez is from Mexico. Bass player Jeff Kinsey is from California. Guitarist Yusuke Sato is from Japan, and drummer Doug Henken is from Norway. So three of the four were in the country on F1 student visas, which expire soon after graduation. So in the spring of 2015, these young musicians faced a new challenge.
To figure out how to keep the band in the country so we can keep making music.
That's Jeff, the American in the group. The other three members were able to extend their stays temporarily. But there are restrictions, like a rule that says you can't work outside of your area of expertise, in this case, making music. So in theory, no waiting tables or washing dishes to help make ends meet between gigs. But Yusuke, the Japanese guitarist, and Mao, the Mexican lead singer, say they're still not sure if non-music work is allowed or not.
Well, that's often very unclear because
it's very unclear.
To a few lawyers, and my lawyer says don't do it. So.
And my lawyer said do it. So
yeah, who knows?
To be safe, Yusuke is only pursuing music work while his visa application is pending, like playing at weddings or giving guitar lessons. But that only goes so far, and it's still temporary. So the band members went looking for a more lasting solution, applying for an O-1 artist visa. They're artists, right? So should be a slam dunk, but it's not.
The O-1s were created by Congress as a way of addressing the fact that performing artists or artists in general are unique in their work and that they're not replaceable.
That's Matthew Covey, an immigration attorney in New York and founder of Tamizdat, a firm that helps artists navigate the U.S. visa process.
In other words, if you want U2 to perform at your festival, it's not good enough to just have Dave Matthews instead.
Works great for famous foreign artists like U2. Not so much for a group of recent college grads with only one EP to their name. The O-1 visa process requires artists to prove that they have exceptional abilities, to distinguish themselves. Which is what the guys in Nightlights have been trying to do for over a year, moving to Los Angeles and booking as many gigs as possible. Oh, and also putting out a second EP called Expectations. I asked Norwegian drummer Doug Henken if the need to prove themselves worthy of O-1 visa status meant more pressure in the recording studio.
I don't know if we were thinking like that. At least for me, I didn't. I wasn't nervous because, like, oh, if I mess up this one take, then, you know, I might be thrown out of the country.
That's how
exactly.
It
is.
If Doug misses this snare hit, he's deported.
They can joke about it now, perhaps because Mao, the singer, finally got his O-1 visa earlier this year. But Dag and Yusuke are still working with an immigration lawyer to secure theirs. They're hopeful, but if they don't get their new visa soon, they may still have to leave the country. So the band's future remains uncertain. Matthew Covey, the immigration lawyer in New York, understands the goal of the O-1 visa program, to regulate which foreign artists and how many are allowed to perform in the U.S. But in the case like Nightlights, he thinks the rules are too strict.
I think that independent young artists, like the ones we're talking about here, contribute an awful lot to American society. And I think that the bars created to keep them out are unnecessarily high.
Meanwhile, Nightlights aren't giving up on their dream of making it, all four of them together as a multinational band. Lead singer Mao Jimenez speaks for all of them when he says,
"There's nothing else that I would rather be doing."
Give me your hand, give me your heart.
For The World, I'm William Troop.
You can hear more of Nightlights music at PRI.org. Finally today, I stopped smoking yesterday, or was it the day before? Just trying to channel Albert Camus there, a big smoker. My last cigarette was actually in April of 1998. Plenty of people still smoke in France, though this week signs that even France is trying to wake up its citizens to the dangers of tobacco the way the U.S. and the U.K. already have. But that also means that, in France anyway, scandal is bound to follow. And here's why. The French are targeting two cigarette brands in particular, Gitane and Gauloise, because they're so culturally distinct and cool. This is France's interpretation of an EU directive on tobacco. That directive states that tobacco products, quote, must not include any element that contributes to the promotion of tobacco or give an erroneous impression of certain characteristics, end quote. Characteristics like cool.
Avec ma Chine, moi ma chien.
Cool, like Serge Gainsbourg with his gravity-defying Gitane hanging on his lower lip. The French crooner was always smoking, always. In 1979, a dozen years before his death, Gainsbourg was on a French talk show, and the host asked him about a serious heart attack he'd had a few years before. Serious, said Gainsbourg? It was nothing. Listen, I smoke, he said. I don't think it was serious. Meaning what? Asked the host. Meaning, replied Gainsbourg, to each his own destiny. That's what I believe. Now, I'm not endorsing smoking here, just saying that Gainsbourg and his fellow chain-smoking compatriots like Jean-Paul Sartre and Albert Camus may have seen a Gitane as a necessary prop for existential angst. But angst is not mentioned in the European Union directive. As the French newspaper Le Figaro reported this week, the directive is clear that those cigarette brands connote masculinity or femininity, physical slimness, youth, or sociability. Yeah, I'm guessing Serge Gainsbourg is spinning in his grave. He's probably even smoking in his grave.
Mieux vaut ne penser à rien que ne pas penser du tout. Rien c'est déjà, rien c'est déjà beaucoup.
That's our show today. Eric Goldberg composed the world's theme music. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We're back here on Monday. Have yourselves a great weekend.
Mieux vaut ne penser à rien que de penser à vous. Ça ne vaut rien.
PRI, Public Radio International.